Hi, everyone. It's Sarah. As you're about to hear, we recorded this episode Saturday morning of last week before we hosted Faded States, our first phone banking session in which Faded Mates listeners like you join Jen and me and best friend Kelly and a bunch of other authors to make phone banking calls to the state of Kentucky as part of the Indivisible Project and for Joe Biden for president. It was an awesome time. About 40 of you listeners turned up to join us and to celebrate democracy with us and to get off the vote in Kentucky. And we had such a good time and did so much good work that Indivisible asked us to host another call-a-thon phone banking session on this coming Saturday. So this episode will drop on Wednesday, and on Saturday, the 3rd of October, we will be hosting another Faded States call-a-thon at 2 o'clock in the afternoon Central Time. We'll be calling North Carolina to support Cal Cunningham for Senate, and we are very, very excited about it. We hope that you'll join us. Again, it's Saturday, October 3rd. At 2 o'clock Central, 3 p.m. Eastern. And we can't wait to see you all there. There will be prizes and special guests, and we're really excited. So we hope you'll join us. Links for that are right at the very top of show notes. Please click on the link and sign up at Indivisible. It's super easy. It's really fun to do it with a bunch of other people who are like-minded romance lovers. And Jen and I can't wait to see your faces. Take care. I think we really did a good job this week.
It was such a delight rereading this book.
It really was, right?
It really was.
I haven't reread this book in a long time.
God, me neither.
And I really love it.
Do you remember? So, oh, wait. Let's introduce ourselves, Sarah. Let's just get right to the beginning and get good stuff over with.
Fine.
Welcome to Faded Mates, everyone.
Welcome.
I'm Jennifer Prokop. I am a romance reader and critic.
I'm Sarah McLean, and I write romances, and I read them.
So, Sarah, tell me, I have a very specific memory that I meant to, like, confirm about when I first learned about Alicia Rye's books, and my memory is, and if I'm wrong, I'll, like, run this down and put it in show notes, is that I was listening to Sarah Wendell on NPR talking about romances and kind of being like, wait, they're talking about romance on NPR? Like, what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
Because this was, like, I don't know when this would have been, where I was just, like, sort of still secretly reading romance myself, but didn't realize there was, like, a romance world. And I think, in my memory, she described A Gentleman in the Street, which is my, like, a real favorite, everyone. It's great. It's so dirty. Mm-hmm. I love all of these. All of her self-published books are, like, yum. Anyway, and I remember her describing, like, it as being, like, five chili peppers. Like, talking about, like, how could we talk about, like, a heat rating scale? And, of course, I was like, I like chili peppers. And I think that's, like, how I found her books was, like, essentially through NPR. So yeah. Thank you, NPR. Thank you.
So you came to her after I came to her because I fell in love with Alicia's writing when I read her paranormal short called Hot for Hades.
Oh, yeah.
Which, actually,
oh,
I should have...
it's so good.
Oh, it's so good, right?
Yeah.
I should have checked this before I got on this morning to record because she pulled it down a year or so back and then sort of had promised that she would re-jack it or read. I mean, I think mm-hmm. she was doing something else with it and going to put it back up again. And I don't know if she ever did put it back up again, but if she did,
it should be Alicia.
Alicia, we're just two girls standing in front of another girl asking her to put her Hades Persephone porn back up.
We are not just two girls because every time this show comes up on, like, Twitter,
Persephone and Hades. Yeah.
Everyone who's read it is like, girl.
It's so good. It's so
amazing.
Good. And also, that is a perfect example of how quickly a novella can world build. Like, it's really excellent. Like, it's so delightful. It's so sexy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was my first taste of Alicia. And then I was really hooked. Like,
yeah.
So I went back and I started reading, and I read kind of everything that she had online, which at the time probably wasn't very much.
Like, right.
And then I read Glutton for Pleasure, which is the first book in this series. because that came out, I don't know when, this came out in 2015, so I don't know when Glutton for Pleasure came out, but Glutton for Pleasure is the sister, I mean, she sort of tells the story in this book, but...
Right.
Raina's sister and the two brothers, the two mm-hmm. like Irish brothers who she mm-hmm. falls for. And they have this like menage, like poly relationship,
oh, yeah.
right? And I remember loving that, like super sexy, like hot brother menage.
I remember thinking that wouldn't be for me. I was wrong. It was, in fact, totally for me.
It was absolutely for you.
It was for me.
And like, that was delicious. And now, do we have to say that they're brothers? So obviously the streams do not cross. So it was sort of, I knew Serving Pleasure was coming. Like, I don't remember this clearly, but I had to have known because I asked Alicia to send it to me. At the time, I was writing the review column for The Washington Post. I had been writing it for about a year, I think. And I asked her to send me Serving Pleasure to read it for the Post. And prior to that time, and we'll put links to all of this in show notes, The Washington Post had a very strict no self-published books policy. And the book page had that policy. And I remember emailing my editor at the time and saying, I have a book I want to include in the column. I think it's absolutely remarkable. And I think you want it in the column. Like, if the goal of that column, and that was the goal I had always been given, was the best three books of the month, right? Then we would be remiss in not including Serving Pleasure in that column. And he was awesome and was like, we've never had a self-published book in the paper before. And I remember having a conversation basically saying, like, you can't talk about romance in 2015 and call yourselves, like, an outlet that comprehensively covers the genre without addressing the fact that a large percentage of romance novels published now are self-published. And stop thinking, everyone, that self-published romance is bad, because a lot of the most kind of interesting books that have come out of romance in the last 5 years, 6 years, seven yeah. years.
10 years.
10 years. I mean, like, there's a reason why we started where we did this year. A lot of the most interesting titles that I've read are self-published. And he was awesome. I didn't have to convince him. So we put Serving Pleasure in the column. And then there was a great piece that came pretty soon after that in the Post about, like, where Alicia got, you know, the credit that was due to her for being the first self-published romance in the Washington Post. Or not romance, self-published book in the Washington Post.
Wow.
So she, you know, I really think Alicia is, I think these books, especially these pleasure books, I think they were such a really delicious erotic romance that really changed the way I was thinking about erotic romance at the time. Like, for me, it's possible. I mean, I don't know. Like, all of that time is very blurry, right? Like, who knows what I was doing? But it's possible that these are the books, and Alicia is the author who showed me that erotic romance was more than a one-handed read.
There was sort of, in my mind, like erotica and then romance, but like the creation of erotic romance as a thing for sure dates to this idea that like having a Five Chili Pepper book didn't mean you couldn't have really like meaty, interesting characters and dilemmas and family drama or, you know, like whatever else was driving the plot besides this. Thank goodness, right? But this book to me, especially revisiting it, because of course I read so much and you are the same, that this is, you know, this was 1,000 books ago for me.
Yeah.
And so when you go back and, I mean, and I know that sounds like hyperbole, but it's really not, right?
It's probably more than 1,000 books away from
And
me.
So to go back and reread something that I really enjoyed and then, but have it, you know, have it be better than I remember even.
It really holds up.
Yes.
I mean, I'm unsurprised that it holds up. Alicia is a very, very excellent writer. But there is something so, it still feels really modern. You know, it gave me a real, I don't feel like at the time I was able to articulate it because I don't think I had thought too much about, well, like I said, I think for me, this was sort of a, this was a new, it was opening up a whole new like part of the romance pool for me in ways, but it has a real Charlotte Stein feel for me, this book.
Yes.
Like, which is interesting because I always think of Charlotte's books as being like so insular, you know, ballet in a phone booth, kind of like two people falling in love in a phone booth books. But for me, what Alicia really captures with Serving Pleasure, more than Glutton for Pleasure, I think, is this idea of like two people having that deeply intense falling in love with a phone booth experience while their actual lives are
still going on. Yes, it's so good.
And that is so magical. And it's something that romance, I feel like the best romance writers are striving for that kind of experience for the reader, where like the romance is so central and so private and so personal and so sexy, but also the story and the book and the world building and the writing is complex enough to keep us engaged in a wider way.
When I'm rereading for the podcast, there's like me reading because I love it, but also me kind of marveling at how it works. And at some point I was like, how is this working as well as it is? Because so an essential question you're always asking is, why can't they be together now?
Yeah.
And here they are together now so quickly. Mm-hmm. And yet we know that it's this emotional reticence that they both have that means they're not really together. And it's so, like, Sarah, it's so good.
It's really deft is what it is, because there's virtually no external conflict in this book.
What we should do is, we should talk about the plot very quickly, and then we should,
I was like,
we're just ranting and raving about how amazing it is.
I mean, I feel like that's the theme of the whole season, but yeah. Joy, 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 everyone, joy.
Always. So, talk about starting in the right place. Raina Malek is next door neighbors with a man she's been spying on for a few months.
But it's fine.
It's fine. Romance reasons. Well, because there's no...
Well, there's no space between their houses.
There's no... Right. And she can see into his studio.
He moved in and he didn't buy curtains. So, I mean, frankly, it's on him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. I think part of the reason it works is because she is kind of horrified that she's spying on him. And so we know that this has been happening. But the night that it changes is the opening scene is our artist, who she doesn't know and she's never met. She's lived next door to him for a couple months, but he's pretty reclusive. They don't seem to, like, cross paths in the driveway or at the mailbox. And it's also really interesting because it's Florida, kind of suburban Florida or a small city in Florida, which is also just, like, an interesting setting, I think.
Yeah, it took me a while to get there, you know. I was like, where are we? Where are we?
Yeah.
Because it, again, it feels like sort of out of space.
Yeah. Well, but it's purposeful on Micah's part. So anyway, he goes into the bathroom. He like walks away from her, goes into another room and comes back. And he is naked and sitting on his couch and masturbating in essentially a way that is just right there for her to see, and she falls to her knees.
Like, I mean, he showers beforehand.
She, like, falls to her knees. Like, I cannot tear myself away from looking at this. And then he, like, sort of gets up and leaves, and she's like, I can't believe I watched this. And then we get his point of view, which is he has been, his name's Micah Hale. He's an artist who suffered a real tragedy in his past and is sort of hiding away. He's British. He's, like, hiding away in this generic Florida nowhere on purpose. But he has been aware of her watching him the entire time, and he has essentially performed for her. And he can't believe he's done it either. And it is, honestly, Sarah,
it's so sexy.
It is so
It's really
sexy.
But here's the thing. I've probably said it 1,000 times on the podcast. In the hands of a lesser author.
Mm-hmm.
Because that moment where she falls to her knees.
Oh, like, yeah.
It could be. It is real dramatic.
Oh,
and it
yeah.
could be, like, but it feels so, like, visceral and, like,
yes.
intense. And you're sort of like, is this happening? Like, what is happening in this book?
I think one of the things that she's, Alicia, is so masterful at is this, like, mind, like, emotional, physical connection. It never feels cheesy. It feels,
it
all
doesn't.
Of it feels so real. The intensity of their
yeah.
feelings and the intensity of their physical response to each other.
Yes.
It is, oh.
I mean, it helps that Alicia wields sex, the writing of sex, incredibly well. There are, you would be hard pressed to find.
Oh, yeah.
You know. A handful of writers who write sex better than Alicia. I mean, it's intense and emotional and private, and, like, you feel like a voyeur when you're reading this book.
Yes.
Which I think is is intentional.
All of it. All
yeah,
of it.
It's really well done.
The way that they then, like, meet each other, right, is she has gone out on some terrible first date. It's so good. She's been essentially promising herself she's going to leave old Raina behind and become new Raina, right? Like, do what her mother wants and find a nice man and get married and settle down. And so she's sort of put her wild past behind her. Her mother thinks she's promiscuous, but Raina's like, I just love sex, and I don't think there's anything wrong with what I was doing, but I have to be different now. I'm 32. And so she dates one man a week. She comes home from a bad date and sees her handsome neighbor get in his car. I mean, he has, like, a man bun, and he's, like, all dressed up, and I'm like, and she follows him in her car.
Like a crazy person. But it's fine. You're like, and what's cool about, here's the thing. If you follow Alicia on Twitter, or if you've ever seen Alicia talk in public, Alicia is very cool. Like, there is a mm-hmm. very real sense of, like, Alicia, she really has her, like, she's aware of the world and, like, women's place in the world. And she's, like, delightfully funny. And she has this magnificent yeah. laugh. And you have this moment. I mean, there are definitely moments in this book where this is a great example. Raina trailing this poor man to wherever he is going, right? It turns
right.
out he's going to an art gallery because he's a painter. And so she's following him in her car, and she, in her head, is like, this is insane. Like,
yes.
I've crossed a lot of lines with this dude already by staring at him through the window, but also, like, this feels like it's really, this is a lot, even
yes.
for me.
I think something, I'm doing something wrong here.
And then, but then she gets there to the gallery, and she parks her car, and she's like, well, I'm here now. And it feels so, she empowers this character so well, because, you know, the choices that are made are not necessarily choices anybody, you know, ordinary would make. But in the moment when Raina makes these choices to get out of her car
yeah.
after her date and go into this gallery, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for Alicia really taking the finger here too, right? Because she easily could have had it be they were at a restaurant. The date was at a restaurant next to the gallery,
sure.
right?
Yes.
And she walks outside. She's had a bad date. She just says, like, thanks, but no thanks to the guy, and then goes into the gallery because she sees him. Yeah. But, like, that's not what happens here. The intentional choice is to make the heroine pursue this hero.
Yes.
In kind of a, like, in an interesting way that really flips the script on a lot of, like, het romance, where, like, mm-hmm. the hero pursues the heroine so devotedly, and, like, we don't hesitate to sort of, like, swoon and say, oh, this is all normal. But in this particular case, like, the heroine is doing the pursuing. I think it's the seed of what eventually will become Gentleman in the Street going on here.
I think you're right, because that, for me, is, like, sort of the pinnacle of her, like, super high-powered. Yeah, right, where, you know, one of the only women billionaire heroines in romance that I can think of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who is delightfully, like, sort of Christian Grey-like, in that she just seems to, like, you know, like, be beautiful and fuck and doesn't do a lot of work, and I'm here for it.
Why should women have to work if men don't? She holds enterprises, limitedly.
Okay, one of my favorite things about Akira, that's the heroine of A Gentleman in the Street, is there's a part, though, where one of her, like, administrative assistants is, like, pregnant. And you could tell this woman was afraid to tell her. And Akira's like, I'm going to just, like, double your salary and you stay home until you need to. And it's just this moment where you realize, I don't know, I just love that moment. I think Alicia's such a smart writer.
I think she really is. Like, Alicia knows what's up.
Yeah.
She knows the way the world works. She knows the way the world treats women. And she, you know, she doesn't have time for it. And frankly, so say we all. And, like, Alicia's worlds are worlds where women are unashamed. Women make choices that make, frankly, the whole world better. And, like, doubling your salary and sending you home until you're ready to come back to work is what, frankly, we should all be doing when somebody gets pregnant.
Absolutely.
So,
sorry, I know there's a digression from this book.
No, I get it.
But I think we talk about how romance is, like, feminist or empowering women, but I think that Alicia's books really write that into being. It's not just lip service.
Correct.
Including all of the muddy, you know, I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing. She sits in her car for 20 minutes before going into that gallery. Well, right?
In that case, that's a solid choice.
Yeah. But I think that's the other thing. Raina is a woman who her entire life has been working on instinct, and it's worked for her. And then she spent a year, like, with her mother in her head telling her not to go with her instincts. And you really see that her warring with herself as she sits in that car.
Well, there's a lot of doubt in this book, a lot of insecurity on the part of both characters. And in both characters, there are real reasons for this insecurity, which is an interesting way of crafting a romance. But in Raina's case, you have a character who is surrounded by people who obviously love her a whole lot, but who doubt her ability to not fuck up. They feel like she's kind of young, like she's still behaving like she's in her early 20s. She's, you know, there's a scene where he comes to the restaurant where her family's restaurant, and her sister walks in on them in a back room. And Raina thinks to her, sees sort of censure in her sister's eyes and realizes that it's not misplaced in the sense that there have been many other times that Raina has been in this back room with men. So Raina is trying to come to terms with who she is when she is a grown-up. And what's interesting is that as a reader, we're kind of constantly given this look at who she believes she needs to be in order to garner respect and authority in some way or another. And the reality is that who she was is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I think specifically the thing that really was so brilliant is, like, this distinction, how your sex life is what we're, your personal foibles are going to be what we judge you on, despite your total professionalism. You know, I mean, like, we find out later she kept the restaurant afloat all through her younger sister's, like, teenage years and after her father's death, and, like, no one gives her credit for this. Mm-mm. And it's this way in which, like, any personal weakness you have is what you're judged on. I just really felt this book. I don't know.
I mean, it feels very real family-wise as well. Like this kind of sense. I think one of the things that you see, and then I want to get to doubt from Micah's perspective, but one of the things that you really feel when you're reading this book, if you are somebody who has grown up with siblings, mm-hmm. is this idea of you are never going to be older than, you know, 12 years old in anyone's mind. Like, your character was solidified in youth, mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter. None of it matters except for the role you played in your family from the start.
Yeah.
And I think it's particularly interesting because Raina is so kind of, Raina's mom's words like echo in her head. She's so keenly aware of like her family with and their relationship to her and how they perceive her and how they feel about her. But Alicia's made a really interesting choice here because her sister is literally in a polyamorous relationship with two brothers.
Right.
Right. So, which is like on the down low, but like, I mean, is obviously happening. Right. So yeah. And it sort of underscores that feeling of reality is sort of unnecessary when it comes to family.
Yes.
Reality is never actually the way a family perceives its members.
It reminded me a lot of the sisters in Joanna Shoup's Uptown Girl series. Mm-hmm. Even though Florence and Mamie are like wild ones, and when Justine steps out, they're like, what are you doing? And I was like, wait, what? And I think that Kelly is really like my sister. Mm-hmm. I don't have a sister of my own, but I find any romance with sisters, I just love it so much.
Yeah. I mean, sisters are complicated. And it's clear that Alicia has a sister, too, because there is a complexity to that relationship that is really authentic here in this book. But I want to go to Micah because Micah has this really dark past.
Very dark, yeah. And we know that from the beginning, something terrible has happened to him. And it turns out that
he's scarred. I love a scarred hero.
Of course, on his face and on his back. It's interesting because he can't hide what's on his face, but he doesn't really want her to see his back. And it turns out that 2 years earlier, a longtime model of his and friend, they were not lovers, had a very jealous boyfriend convinced that she was cheating on him with Micah. And he shows up in the studio and stabs Micah like several times and cuts his face and then leaves him for dead.
Yeah.
And this has created, I mean, obvious,
I mean,
know, I don't even know the obvious, you know, trauma for Micah, but also trauma in the way that he, I mean, this part's really interesting, sees himself. Who was I before and how can I get back there is sort of the way he perceives what he wants. I just want to get back to that place, but the art he makes is different. His relationship with his loving parents is different. And he, part of his fleeing to Florida was sort of this, I need to be somewhere where nothing reminds me of my life in London.
Well, and that's where I was going with doubt.
Yeah.
There is such immense doubt in Micah. Mm-hmm. Doubt about him, obviously himself physically, but also about his art.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't been able, you know, I mean, I love this. This is, I mean, it's such shorthand in romances and I fucking love it. But like, he couldn't paint before he noticed that she was watching him. And like, that's the same as he can't sleep. It's Scotty, right? I can't sleep without you.
Yeah.
And so in this, so he's got these kind of deep rooted insecurities that are reasonable, that are born of trauma.
Yeah.
And then he has on top of it, this kind of sense of at the moment they sort of interact for the first time physically, once they've had sex, it sort of all weights. It gets very weighted down mm-hmm. for him. And not in the book doesn't get weighted down, but like suddenly everything feels heavier with
yes.
doubt. Yes. That he can do this, that he can, you know, and so they make a sex deal. I mean, I love a sex deal.
And by the way, it was, so she says, I have some conditions.
Yeah.
And she lists them, and then she's the one who says, and you can't fall in love with me. I was like,
perfect.
Girl, I love this fucking woman
it's
so
perfect.
Much. Right? I can't fall in love with me. And it's the end of the chapter. And then the next chapter, it's so brilliant, is her saying or thinking to herself,
yeah.
And I can't fall in love with him either.
Yeah.
But to have her be the one that says, like, this is the danger. We're going to do this. But to be his muse is, I mean.
Yeah. Oh,
is well, there anything they hotter?
They make this sex deal. He's a painter. I mean, this is one of those situations, you know, Jen talks all the time about fossils, right?
Right.
About the way that, you know, we've talked, we did a whole episode on competence porn, right? Mm-hmm. Like this idea that people who are exceptionally skilled at their work or at a task are sexy in some way, right? Painters get that, you know, on steroids because they're also artists.
Yeah. Hello.
And I mean, if you put a painter on the page, the promise of the premise is that he's going to want to paint her.
Obviously.
That he's going to want to paint her portrait. It's if you put a photographer on the page, the promise of the premise is they're going to take pictures of the other character, of the other love interest. And so in this particular case, of course, we get to this place where, you know, he is sort of struggling. You can sort of see that they are dancing around each other. They've had a one-night stand. The deal was just one night. I love a just one-night deal. Just to get it out of his system.
There's no condoms.
Perfect.
And she's like, what kind of, you should have stopped for them on the way over. You knew what we were going to do.
Yeah. And then if you know or follow Alicia online, you know Alicia has a purse love. And oh, yeah. So there's like this, it's like a little Alicia Rye Easter egg when it's Raina great. Like starts throwing purses out of her closet, just looking for one that might have a condom in it. So they have this one night sex thing and then they separate for a week. And it's clear that like neither of them are happy. They want to go back to this. It was intense right. And like the best sex that they've ever had. And it was terrific sex, P.S. And then terrific.
Like backbreaking. It was amazing. Come on.
Yeah. And then they get to, and then, you know, he meets... They, you know, he goes to her family's restaurant to find her and they make a deal that they're going to do it again. Mm-hmm. But he's so in his head about what that experience is and like fear of a relationship or fear of emotions or fear of, you know, commitment because of everything that it could mean in the long run for him traumatically. He kind of throws in like McGreeve brain kind of,
yeah,
you know, well, why don't you let me paint you? Like,
yeah,
I want to paint you. And then that's the deal. They're going to work. It's a ticking clock. She's so deftly layers for a book that doesn't have a ton of external conflict. She deftly layers these kind of really cornerstone romance tropes, right? Like just one night, just to get it out of my system, mm-hmm. sex deal, ticking clock, because I'm going to paint this portrait of you and it's going to require a series of sketches and then a painting, but you can't love me. And so by layering in all these like really deep internal conflict things, plus these tropes, you've got yourself a really meaty book. And proves that you don't need, you know, if you're doing this deftly, if you're doing this layering deftly as a writer, you don't need the extra stuff. There's not a single fossil in here. And there is a lot of, like, painting, like, families, food.
Everything counts, though. The thing that I also thought was so sexy in this book was about, like, being naked, about... Mm-hmm. how comfortable she was with her body and yeah. how much she loved him watching her and drawing her. And that was so fascinating to me because that's not something I feel, but just in the world, right? But just that I loved that part of her. And I felt like it's one thing to show us or tell us, right? I mean, I think we talk a lot about, like, show versus tell. But, like, here's a woman who's like, yeah, I love sex. It's great. But, and I've never been ashamed of my past, starting with the boy I got caught, who I let feel me up at 13. But the way in which she loves just, like, posing for him, it's just such an amazing way of showing that. And the way that he, like, there's a part where, like, they get so caught up in each other that they agree to, like, set a timer for 2 hours. Like, they have to get 2 hours of work in before they can, you know, like, stop, right? To have sex. And it's so, I mean, it's so intense. It's, like, supercharged. And this is why I think, you know, talking about this as erotic romance, the intimacy at the beginning, right? The one night stand, which is at her house. And then most of the rest of their love affair is at his house, mm-hmm. where they're, like, hidden away. You know, he doesn't really have any furniture. It's just in the studio. And then there's a scene where it's in his room. I mean, if you want to, like, if you were like, I don't understand what people mean when they talk about how the sex scenes are doing work, pay attention to the ways in which where they are, who interrupts them, how it feels when they are interrupted, right? Because there's two different scenes where, like, their mothers interrupt.
Yeah.
One is, right, she's sleeping at his house and the phone rings and it's his mother.
I love that scene with his mom.
Yeah.
It does so much emotional work and heavy lifting. I don't want to, I want you to finish, but then I want to come back to that scene.
No, go ahead, because then we can talk about the scene with her mother, which is the same but very different.
Yeah. So it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and granted, like, his family lives in England, so fine. It's late, but it's later there. But it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and Raina is sleeping in his bed, and the phone rings, and he has the same phone ring as she does. So she picks up the phone, and it's his mom saying, hello. And she's like, oh, shit. Like, it's his mother. I shouldn't have answered. But they have this really kind of sweet, quick conversation where Raina describes herself to his mother as his model, which is not inaccurate, but they've just boned till next Tuesday. So it's, you know, not exactly accurate either. But she doesn't know what else to say, because how do you describe what's happening between them? So she says she's his model. And then she gets up and finds him painting, or she finds him in his studio, like, fussing around. And she says, your mom called. And he's like, you talked to my mom.
Yeah.
And she said, and then he says, I have to call her back. Like, she calls me at odd times. And it's so clear that she calls him at odd times because she is concerned about his safety. Like, she too has been traumatized as a mother.
As a mother.
Right? So he calls her back, and Raina is listening, and he says, no, she's my model.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of, like, heartache there.
Yeah.
That's just about, so Eric and I started dating when we were practically babies, and it was the first Thanksgiving that he came home with me to Rhode Island from New York. And we had been, I mean, like, he had moved to New York for me. Like, we were together. There was no, like,
ambivalence.
No, we were together. And so we were at the mall at my parents', like, in my parents' hometown, because what else do you do when you're in the suburbs but go to the mall?
I don't know.
So we were at the mall, and we met the woman who, there was, you know, a woman sort of called my name, and I turned around, and there was a woman standing there, and she had been my babysitter when I was young. My mom had worked, you know, both my parents worked, and so a few days a week I had gone to this, like, woman's house. Like, she had a sitting service. And so I had basically grown up, like, at this woman's house, and she recognized me in the mall. And so we hugged, and I turned to introduce her to Eric. And I looked at Eric, this man who I was, like, you know, having sex with and, like, who had moved across the country for me. And I said, this is my friend, Eric.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, Eric, it's nice to meet you. And they, you know, shook hands and whatever. Right. And afterward, he was so mad at me.
Yeah.
Because I had called him my friend instead of like my boyfriend or my, I mean, I don't know.
Right.
We were, it was so, it, but it was that moment where I was like, I didn't know. I felt weird. Like,
yeah.
Even in that moment, right? Articulating the relationship in a like significant way.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. So there's just a very real moment. It's a very real moment when like somebody says, oh, this is my, no, right. She's my model.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but we just, you know, we yeah. just had backbreaking sex.
Like, right.
Are you kidding?
Right.
But she didn't. And so there's, and that sort of sense of both. She wants it both ways, too. She doesn't want to acknowledge that it's a relationship, but she also doesn't just want to be the model. So anyway, Eric, you married me, ultimately. And now when I introduce you, I do call you my husband. So
well done. Well done. Yeah.
I figured it out in the long run.
Okay. So this scene where her mother interrupts them,
mm-hmm.
I think—
It's different.
It's different, but it's brilliant in a different way because— Remember, old Raina was this, like, troublemaker who was with too many men. And she's really, her mother is in her head. And she really wants to please her mother. And so this is one of the first times that we see them then having sex again in Raina's home. And, like, he's come over and he just, like, can't wait for her. And you're like, oh, it's going to be good. And they're, like, literally, like, you know, on the couch. They can't even make it upstairs. And the door opens. And it is such a powerful, like, emotional moment where you see, like, we have been adults doing something fun in my home that I own. Mm-hmm. But now my mother has walked in and I'm 16 again.
Yeah.
And again, like, the sexual journey of this couple from one night stand now to, like, really, like... I don't know, uncovering Raina's, like, most painful, like, I don't know, like, self-abnegation, right? The ways in which she really has internalized all these things her mother has felt about her. It's, you know, it's her, like, having to, like, worry her boobs are falling out of her bra, which had been, you know what I mean? It's really, to be 32 and have your mother, like, have that power over you still.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's real, too.
Of course it is.
So, I mean, that's why I love this book so much, is it's so sexy. And it is, like, on the surface, this kind of easy, erotic romance. But every word is so perfectly chosen. Yeah. And every scene is so perfectly crafted. And that scene, I mean, like, you and I are in our 40s, Jen. Yeah. And
oh,
we
God.
Text about our moms sometimes.
We do.
And, like, because it's complicated, that relationship.
Yeah, of course. She,
you know, it's that old adage that, like, your family knows where your buttons are because they installed
yes.
them.
Yes, right.
And your mothers install buttons, especially
yes.
in daughters, especially.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I mean, the other thing I was thinking as I was reading this is, like, I was like, look, I'm a white lady. So the cultural level of what's going on
right.
in Raina's family and, like, her disappointment of her mother and, you know, the expectation of, like, marriage and, right, like, I don't think I'm the right person to sort of speak to that
right.
in particular. But the ways in which that, like, push-pull between our mothers and how we... want to be ourselves, but still, like, what Raina wants is her mother's acceptance for
of
who
course.
She is now, right? Not who she has to turn into be. And this is true for all of them, but the scene where she and her mother then, like, essentially fight on the front steps of her house mm-hmm. while Micah is inside.
Awkward.
But also, like, so powerfully symbolic of, like,
yes.
you can't, who, the person who gets to be in my home is the person who accepts me for who I am. And she tells him, like, you have to stay here. And there's this beautiful line where she thinks, something about, like, she knew she'd need him to console her. And then here it is, like, you've been preparing your whole life to, like, say the things you need to say to your mother. You know, like, the part where her mother essentially calls her promiscuous.
Yep.
Like,
well,
you're never gonna get a man, and now's your chance. You're still pretty. That's all you've got going for you. It was devastating to read it.
Yes. And then there's that moment too where Raina names it, like really says it. And she says, if I were a man, you wouldn't care if I was sowing my wild oats. And the mom says, you're not a man, you're a woman. And this is the way the world works.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, and then she says, like, it shouldn't work that way. And then there's a whole, you know, don't you want to get married? I mean, like, that whole argument is so important. And then on top of it, there's so much packed in, and there's like the conversation about Micah as an artist, like where the mom is like, I've thrown doctors at you. What are you doing? Like, you are a mess. And it feels so heavy. Like, again, just it weights the whole thing down with this very powerful sense of like, this isn't external conflict that can be resolved. This is some internal shit that has to be unpacked and like restructured. And there is, as you said, there's a whole separate layer of this that is about the fact that Raina is Desi. Culturally, this is, you know, I'm also a white lady, so it's different. You know, I'm not able to speak to it either, but I think Raina's cultural experience is so beautifully imbued in this whole book, as, you know, as was her sister's in Glutton for Pleasure, which is, you know, really centers, everybody knows I love, you know, food as a love language, but also, you know, the sister is a chef. So like, you know, their restaurant is an Indian restaurant. Like, there's so much richness to this too, from that perspective. But I mean, Alicia doesn't let up. It's all there. It's all out there.
All along, as a reader, I'd been sort of wondering, well, wait, what was the problem with old Raina? Like, what exactly was wrong? And I think then this is the moment where you, as the reader, are like, well, wait, nothing was wrong with you. You're trying to please someone who, like, if you have to change yourself so fundamentally, if you have to, like, sort of say, that's not who I'm going to be at all anymore, then this isn't, you know, this isn't great either. And I think this is also the moment where I started, as she's, like, fighting with her mother. Even though I'd read this book before, I was like, Micah's about to fuck this up. Mm-hmm. Because he is not as brave as she is. He's been hiding away. She has been, too, to a certain extent. But this is the moment where she really, like, sort of says to her mom, like, look, you're not going to do this to me anymore. I can't. And so to have the, like, double whammy, essentially, of this fight with her mother, then be followed up by this breakup with her man, I mean, I cried a little, Sarah. I'm not going to lie to you. I was like, this is devastating.
It's so emotional. I mean,
really is.
I mean, the scene with the mom is,
it's amazing.
It's really beautiful. And it, you know, there's the moment where the mom, I forget what word she uses, but she basically is like, you're too emotional for this. Like, I can't have this conversation with you. And like, I mean, there's that, it hurts so much. I mean, like, that's such an infuriating thing to hear from anyone. Like, you're being unreasonable. But when you hear it from your parent, right, from your mother, it feels so personal. It feels like you're not understanding that, like, I'm emotional because I'm emotional. Like, because I'm having actual real emotions in this moment. Like, so you're right. I'm being emotional. But, like, I need you to acknowledge it. And instead, and I mean, look, my mother's English, so, you know, emotions are not allowed, like, in this scenario. And it feels really real. Like, it's beautiful. And Micah's doing, but at the same time, like, Micah makes, you know, does this breakup, but it makes, like, he's just trying to figure out how to make it better. God, men are so dumb. And they're like, how do I solve the problem?
Yeah. He has his own issues with his parents and, you know, he has to work through. But the thing that she says to him at this moment is like, I'm just a step to you. You're just on some journey back to like being your normal self. And I was just a step. And part of me is like, I wonder if I like repressed all this because it was like so hard to read. It was so good. This is what romance is so good at. But this moment where to be let down by everyone at the same time, it was just so devastating. And then to have her sisters be the ones who don't let her down was...
It's the right choice.
It is the right choice because we need these people to be whole and moving forward. And so the best part is, like, she calls her sister and she's like, I think I'm going to cut my hair. And Lena's like, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And I was... like, and then we get this scene where, like, there's finally the sisters talk to each other and, you know, sort of admit all the things that they had been feeling. And, you know, I still am like, I had forgotten how much I wanted Lena's book and hope that Alicia still has that in her brain somewhere. Yeah. Because, like, a short story, a paragraph, like a quick update on Lena. But I think that that's the part then when we get the sisters that you really profoundly realize that her alienation from her mother, she had allowed to sort of alienate herself from her sisters too. Mm-hmm. And her own anger at herself for like doing something dumb and being, I mean, it just really was. And so then you realize like, oh, the thing that old Raina did was like care too much, but act too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then her sisters are the ones who are like, that's okay though. We love you. Oh, God, Sarah, the emotional journey of this book.
Yes.
With each of them individually as a couple and then with their families. And it's so tightly done. It's so good.
It's really what's fascinating about it is you can see all the bones of Alicia's later books here, right?
Yes, I was thinking that too.
I can't imagine an Alicia Rye book that doesn't really deeply explore all these like complicated emotional mm-hmm. relationships within families. Mm-hmm. I think about her Forbidden Hearts series.
Yep.
And how family plays such an important role in all of those books.
Yes.
She has to be one of the best romance writers writing families.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This kind of family dynamic, the skill that she has for it is not seen regularly. I mean, like, I think about it, right? Because I think about all the books that we talk about that we love and how few of them have families. I mean, certainly in older romances, like, you know, romances that come, you know, this season we're talking about modern romance. But when you look back to romance prior to, say, 2010, families often are left by the wayside. Like maybe yeah. there's one family member, but like the complex nuance of family isn't something that you see that often in romances, you know, except for when you see them in like big family romances. But even then, you never get into the dirty bits.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like the unpleasant conversations that happened, like the way that we push the buttons we installed. That doesn't happen in the Bridgerton books. It doesn't happen in the Sinster novels. Like it happens in this book.
And, you know, I mean, to be fair, sometimes I can get overwhelmed by that because the way that this book works for me so well is... I mean, if I wanted to read about big, like, family dramas, I probably wouldn't read a lot of romance. So to have, I mean, this is like a real tightrope that Alicia's walking. And
she's just good at it.
She's just good at it. And yes. The focus is so intensely on them for so much of the book. But you realize there's all these, like, breadcrumbs that family drama is what's causing them to sort of retreat from the world. And there's this way in which they're profoundly alike. And then to have it all kind of like bubble up, both as like the kind of the inciting incident for the breakup is mom's arrival, but also the fixing of it is her sisters. And I think that that's the part where it's so well done because it helps us understand why they weren't working or why they couldn't work. And so then when we see her, I mean, especially Raina with her sisters, when we see the way this is changing and working, it all helps me understand how their love story is going to play out.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, again, that's a specific need for romance, that I want the romance to be first. And I think that that's why this book is so perfect. The romance is first, but we're never, it's not like them, the phone booth is like them, you know, the family's all there still too. It's not just nothing else exists.
That's why if it has, like I said at the beginning, it has that feel of like being private and mm-hmm. voyeuristic when they're together alone. But yeah. like then suddenly they're, what's amazing is it does, like she so deftly shows you that there's a world outside the phone booth.
Yeah.
I don't know how she does it. It's really well done.
Oh, yeah.
And then on top of it, it's so romantic.
Oh, yeah.
The painting at the end. Where oh, he, I mean, God. Like, please, put it in my veins, right? Like, where he, like,
yeah.
paints her in a way.
The queen of my heart.
I'm right. Stop. Curtains, arms, heart open, all for you. Like, it's so, like, desperately romantic.
Yeah.
And, like, all you want is these two broken people to be together. And, like, but then they're not broke. Like,
they're not broken, right?
They've healed themselves together. I mean, I do love the fact that he calls a therapist at some point.
Yes.
Makes an appointment that feels so, like, modern and great. Like,
and also evolved. That he says to her, like, I don't want you to be one of my steps because I want to. And, I mean, this is brilliant, too, right? The problem with a very broken person in a romance is you have to believe that they can be healthy on their own without the other person.
Of course.
So the fact that, I mean, I will say it's not really groveling necessarily, but like the, you know, sometimes I, you know, I want, you know, the whole, there's like a conversation sometimes about like that third act breakup in a romance. And it feels like fake to some mm-hmm. people, right? It's just like, this is the way the plot goes. So they have to break up. And then like the next morning, they realize like, oh, I made a mistake. And I really loved that this book took 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
you know, really for him to figure out, hey, I need to like get myself right and show her that I can do that independent of her. And and a really other important part of that is he finds artistic, you know, he talks to his old model and he, like, she helps him, like, envision that this is not, like, going back to his old life, but just, like, a new part of who he is. It'll just be different. And he feels a spark of, I don't know, like, artistic, whatever people have when they're artists, right? Inspiration that is not about Raina. And I thought that was really important.
Important.
Right? Yes. It's not like I've now tied my well-being to you.
Yeah. Muse isn't a great role for a partner.
No.
It's great. That sex scene where he paints her, forget it. It's so good. And it's, again, like, it's like, that's the promise of the premise, right? An erotic romance with a painter. They're definitely going to have sex and there's going to be a paintbrush involved. And like,
sure.
And it is great. I mean, like, God. it is a magnificent book. It remains my favorite of Alicia's books.
I still love A Gentleman in the Street. But you know what? This and Serving Pleasure and Glutton for Pleasure, I guess all three of them are like pretty tied though. They're all so good.
If you are out there and you are thinking like, how do I write erotic romance, but like really level up in some yeah. way? I think you would be hard pressed to find somebody who does it better than this. It is such a complicated book and
yes.
so deftly written. Like it seems so simple and it
yeah.
is so complicated. And I mean, it's really a magnificent romance. And it gave me a lot of joy to reread it this week.
Oh God, yes.
Yeah. And it just made me happy and
yeah.
it made me hungry and it made me like want to just like, you know, it made me happy because it has been a while since I have read a book that I really, really loved. Like, really wanted to, like, roll around.
Savor. Yeah. I read this really slow.
Yeah. Because it is, like, it's a warm yeah. hug of a.
Yeah, it is. Well, a hot, sexy man bear of a, I've got a man bun hug, sure.
I mean, yeah, all of that, too. I mean, the devil of downtown, right? But yeah, it's just great. If you did not read it this week and you are having existential despair like Jen and I are, like, yeah, this is a really solid choice for a read in the lead up to the election.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make you really happy.
So I was thinking a lot about women in the world. And one of the things I was thinking a lot about is, and we talked about this a little earlier, but like, Raina is, so she's a daughter, she's a sister, she's like the front woman at the restaurant. There's a way in which this is such a whole picture of her, both for like all the things that she does so well, but also all of the ways in which it's hard to recognize the things we do well. And I felt like there's something that really moved me about this in 2020. Here we all are having 20 spinning plates going at a time. And I don't just mean women now. I just mean all of us. And we have the things we worry about and our personal desires, our professional desires, our family obligations. And the thing that she says over and over again that just really moved me is like she has this realization that she doesn't want marriage. She just wants love.
That's what she says to her mom in that fight. Yeah.
And she kind of is able to name it, but it's the point where she realizes they're not the same. My mom wants me to be married. I want love. And Micah is the one I can have that with.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful. It's what romance is, again, like supposed to do is say, like, you and all your imperfections are still brilliant and amazing and fucking perfect, and you deserve love.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good, Sarah.
I know. I'm really glad we picked this one.
It was such a pleasure to reread it. It really was. Lena broke up with her boyfriend.
I mean, clearly Lena's being set up, but go read Forbidden Hearts, I guess.
You know, people have heard me say this. People are like, are you ever going to write a romance? And I was like, yeah, God, no, I don't have that in me. My brain does not think that way, but I spent a lot of time this morning thinking about Lena and, like, who would make Lena happy? Who does Lena need?
And did you sort it out?
No, because I'm not a fucking writer. Alicia, goddamn, can you just, like, leave me a voicemail and just say she's happy? Like, two sentences. I have no idea. God, I don't know what Lena needs, but she needs to be happy. Fuck.
Here's my thing. I'm pretty sure that if Alicia were here right now, she would tell you Lena is happy.
Okay, well.
That is the one promise of the premise that we all sort of agree on is if there's a halfway decent character in a book.
Yeah, sure.
He or she or they might not receive a happily ever after on page, but they definitely get one.
In our hearts,
in theory. Just, if not in practice.
I was like, maybe like the Hades. Okay, it is not available, by the way. I did check.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, everyone. I teased you, but it was great.
Those of us who have it still on our Kindle from before are going to be rereading it. Woo!
Okay, so what are we doing? So now we are officially finished with the first few reads of the season. We are holding October close.
Yes.
Because we want to make sure that we celebrate joy. Mm-hmm. As much as we can. So we have invited some of our favorite people to come on the podcast for October and talk about books that give them joy and writing that gives them joy. Next week, we'll have Christina Lauren with us.
Yep.
And they will be talking about fanfic and how they came to romance via fanfic and how much fanfic sort of inspires them and how much honestly it fanfic kind of inspires romance right now.
Yes.
As a modern genre. And it was a great conversation, I think.
It was really fun.
Because Jen and I are not fanfic readers as a matter of course. And so it was just fascinating, but also really full of full of joy. Like these two people love. They came on to talk about something they love. We also have more guests coming for the rest of the month. They will all be speaking about things that they love too.
Right.
Some of them will feel more like interstitials. Some of them will feel more like conversations. We're just going to play it as Play it as it lies, so to speak.
Yeah.
Jen and I are going to host put it on your calendar, Wednesday, November 4th. We are going to do a live. We don't know what that will look like. Who can say what that will look like? There will be a short episode that goes up as usual on Wednesday the 4th that is taped, but we are going to host a live in the evening on the 4th, and we will have more information about that. What else do we want to say? Volunteer, make calls. We have just, over the weekend, had our first Faded Mates call. Faded States phone-a-thon. Lots of people showed up for it. Hopefully it's this afternoon, but I'm going to speak in the past tense. I'm putting it into the world that lots of people showed up for it. We have 45 RSVPs, so I feel good about it. We're calling Kentucky this afternoon. So we will, I'm sure, have tweeted and Instagrammed the, you know, feedback from it. And if it goes really well, we're planning to do maybe another one. So keep an eye on that. Join us for another one. There are giveaways and stickers and pins from Kelly. And then what else? Sign up to text bank, sign up to send postcards. Make sure that if you're voting early, you are voting as early as possible, because we want to make sure every ballot gets counted.
Yes.
We're still real mad. Call your senators. The new judicial nominee is going to be announced today. We are expecting it to be somebody just absolutely atrocious. So make sure you're calling your senators. You're making sure that you're telling them that you want the McConnell rule to be enforced, and that the winner of the election should be the one to seat the justice. Keep your eye on the prize in that sense. They want to distract us by the nominee herself, but I really think we got to focus on them power grabbing here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people, we're going to just keep fighting.
That's all you can do.
That's all you can do. Keep loving, too.
Same. Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
All right, my loves, we will see you next week with Christina Lauren.
Yeah.
Stay safe out there.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nisha Sharma, and I am the author of The Takeover Effect, which is the first in the Singh family trilogy about three brown billionaire brothers. Jen and Sarah had suggested that I call in about a book that bloodied me, and it's taken me a while to come up with one, because for me, that category has such emotional significance from the time in my life that I read the book. So finally, my recommendation is Angel's Blood by Nalini Singh. Angel's Blood is a paranormal romance. It came out in 2009, and it's the first in the Guild Hunter series. I was in the second year of law school, my second year of law school at the time, and Nalini was a new-to-me author. I found her book on a best-of recommended list, and I had kind of been exhausted with Twilight Fever at the time. I was exhausted with the vampire myths that were coming out. But Nalini's book took this vampiric legend and flipped it on its head, and then she added angels to the mix. Yes, angels. In the story, you have a human guild hunter who is basically like a modern take on Buffy. And I was obsessed with Buffy growing up, so I was there from the very beginning for this book. And then you also have this archangel who is at a point in his life where he's losing his sense of humanity and compassion, and he has very little regard for human life. So there's technically no way these two can ever be together, and you feel like it's doomed from the beginning. But then this brilliant, beautiful, sparkling love story sprouts through this terrible conflict until you're crying at the very end of the story, swearing you'll never read another romance unless this book has an HEA. And spoiler, it does, but man, you are dragged through a very difficult journey to get there. So Nalini renewed my obsession in paranormal romance, and I have become a lifelong fan and gratefully a friend of hers. I highly recommend this book to anyone who wants alpha males and deadly heroines and forbidden love stories. Thanks, Jen and Sarah, for your fabulous podcast, and I can't wait to hear everyone else's books that bloodied them. Have a good one.